situation that needs to be reversed. At the same time, there's a broader supply problem, which demands more housing, which will really only the private sector is in a position to provide because of the way our economy and our housing market works. Is that crazy, or is that consistent or compatible with the perspective that you're laying out?
It's compatible, I think. You know, I do think that in certain, like, you know, the single family home, for example, like, should it, from a climate perspective and, you know, from a community perspective, should it continue to be the ideal? That's a whole other conversation, right? But, you know, I would argue probably no, but that's a different conversation. But, you know, like, for folks who can afford to participate in housing in the private market, sure, right? Like, and, you know, like I've said to developers, like, yeah, great, go and build me a home. I live in a privately owned home. So, you know, no big deal there. But really it is, and this is where our lab is focusing on more, is really that low to mid-range, like low to middle income folks. Because it's becoming like, we look at, you know, in the past, it was really, we would focus on folks who were experiencing deep poverty. So often those who were on social assistance or disability supports. And like affording anything off of that in New Brunswick, it's like $639 a month for social assistance for a single adult. Find me an apartment that you can rent for that. You can't, right? So where do you live? Well, I don't know, right? Like, this is becoming a huge issue. You can maybe get a room in a house, maybe. So the low to mid range, and I say to mid now, because now we see folks who are making minimum wage who can't afford anything out there in the market, or even slightly better than minimum wage. And that's where we see these government solutions coming in. And that's where we see the biggest push for decommodification needed.
I understand you're working on a new national survey. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. That one's an interesting one. It should be hopefully launching in the new year. The new national survey we're working on is actually funded through the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation through their 2022 President's Medal for Outstanding Housing Research, which my work on the flooding received. And the work itself, or the survey itself, actually was supposed to be focus groups originally. We were going to do focus groups with folks who had experienced housing displacement or loss or damage because of climate or climate disasters. And then all of a sudden, Canada went on fire this summer, and there were fires absolutely everywhere. So then I decided to turn it into a survey, just to kind of get at some of those realities without being as invasive to folks who were living through, when I was starting writing the survey draft, who were living actively through climate disasters. So basically what we're doing is we are doing a large survey to look at people's experiences of either displacement, so if they were asked to leave their housing during a fire, evacuation, damage, or destruction of their homes. So they have to fit into one of those three categories, and they have to relate this to some kind of severe weather event. So whether it be a fire, a flood, et cetera. And basically what we're looking for is we're looking to see how their needs were met or not met, how different aspects of vulnerability, so for example, gender, age, health status, how those impacted their experiences of the disaster. And then we're going to be asking them a little bit about policy as well, too. So what do they think governments should do to respond to the very real threat of losing housing because of climate disasters that seems to be, you know, and is increasing, and I believe will continue to increase as we sort of move along in time.
Well, it sounds like a really exciting and certainly a timely project, and one that is only going to get more relevant, I think, as we go forward. Thank you so much for this, Julia. It's been a really interesting and informative conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Big Thinking Podcast and to my guest, Julia Woodhull-Melnick, Associate Professor at the University of New Brunswick. I also want to thank our friends and partners at the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and at Cited Media, whose support helps make this podcast possible. Let us know what you thought of this episode and share your feedback with us on social media. If you enjoy the Big Thinking Podcast, check out Social Science Bites. It's a podcast series appearing on Sage's Social Science Space website. The monthly episodes offer 20-minute interviews with leading social and behavioral scientists who share their perspectives on topics ranging from crowd psychology and behavioral economics to inequality and even the fear of death. Follow us for more episodes of the Big Thinking Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast. À la prochaine.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, April 11th, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Freedom of peaceful assembly, or in other words, to protest, and the freedom of association are among the fundamental freedoms guaranteed by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Protest has been a vital aspect of Canada's democracy and social fabric since the country's formation, playing a key role in advancing Indigenous rights, environmental causes, 2S LGBTQ+, and feminist issues, and labor rights. This past week alone, people in various cities across the country came together to protest against the threats to Canadian sovereignty made by U.S. President Donald Trump. And sure, we might not all agree with every protest which happens in our cities and communities. The Freedom Convoy of 2022 comes to mind. But as stated in our charter, as long as the protests do not include hate speech, become violent, incite violence, or pose a danger to public safety, we have decided as a country that the right to protest is more important than agreeing with every protest that is organized. It is crucial that we are able to express our opinions, criticize our governments and institutions, and participate in public discourse. This is why the City of Toronto's recent survey and proposed bylaw about demonstrations near vulnerable institutions is sounding some alarm bells. This week on Rabble Radio, Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow Ashley Ray Thomas sits down with Samira Moyeddin to talk about what this bylaw is and why it is being considered, why the right to protest is so important, and the Palestine exception. Here is that conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today, Samira.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Are you able to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
Sure. My name is Samira Moyeddin. I am a producer and broadcaster. I founded my own media company back in November of 2023 called On the Line Media. And before that, for nearly a decade, I was a producer at CBC Radio's The Current and a host at CBC Podcasts.
So today we're going to be talking about the City of Toronto has put out a survey asking Torontonians what they think about these vulnerable zones. Can you share what you know about it?
Yeah, so this is a survey that the City of Toronto put out, and I think the deadline if I'm not mistaken, for citizens to respond and fill out the survey is May 1st. And it came about because two City of Toronto councillors, specifically James Pasternak and Brad Bradford, had put out a call and they want to put in place a bylaw to prevent people from demonstrating in what they're calling, quote unquote, vulnerable institutions. So this could include art galleries. It could include religious institutions like synagogues, mosques, etc. And some of the questions that the survey asks are a bit ludicrous and absurd. For instance, it asks, as a citizen, when you encounter a demonstration or a protest, how do you feel? And then it asks you to check off certain feelings like, do you feel scared? Do you feel engaged? Are you happy that it's happening? Do you wish it wasn't occurring? Are you having difficulty getting to where you want to go to? So sort of asking citizens to engage with how they feel when they encounter protests. And these safe, what are called bubble zones, what they're trying to create, these safe bubble zones for these quote-unquote vulnerable institutions, is something that was already put in place in the city of Vaughan. This is about an hour outside of downtown Toronto. And also in Montreal, and I believe Brampton also has this right now. What it's really doing is making protesting illegal in certain areas, and it wants to criminalize protests in certain areas. And it was really brought about not just by these two councillors, but really Jewish groups and organizations were trying to get people to stop protesting in front of synagogues. And in order to tell you sort of where that came from, last year in March, March 8th, I believe, there was a real estate blitz in Vaughan where a synagogue was selling occupied Palestinian lands in the occupied West Bank. There were realtors there. There were mortgage brokers and lawyers all ready to sort of sell land, but it was happening inside a synagogue. So people came and protested outside of the synagogue. And of course, because of that, those protesters were categorized as being anti-Semitic and the protest itself being hateful, etc. And of course, the media didn't really follow up on, you know, what was actually happening inside that synagogue to make all these people protest. People weren't protesting outside of synagogues before this real estate blitz happened. So that's sort of the context of how this bylaw or sort of survey came about to bring about a new bylaw to deal with protests.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that the day that the protesters like marched up University passing Mount Sinai and then the media just latched onto that as anti-Semitic, I don't think that that had no influence on this proposed bylaw.
No, it didn't. And, you know, again, just to come back to what you were saying, that was another instance where tens of thousands of people were marching. And that's just that Hospital Row was on that marching route. And I was actually there documenting that same person. It was a man in a Spider-Man outfit. He was climbing on top of everything, light poles, whatever, particularly anything that had scaffolding on it. And so Mount Sinai at the time was doing construction and there was huge scaffolding up there. And of course, again, people latched onto this and said, you know, they're anti-Semitic. This is a Jewish hospital. You know, it had nothing to do with that. I mean, he also climbed on top of the Eaton Center. You know, does that make him hateful against Anglo-Saxon people? I mean, these things are absurd. But of course, you know, they're grasping for whatever way they can to criminalize protest against Israel's actions in Gaza. And that is really what this is born out of.
What are some of the things that we've seen the city do to criminalize protests and protesters in Toronto?
I mean, there's lots of things. There are noise bylaws. There are these certain bylaws that want to make it illegal for you to protest outside certain institutions. So, for instance, when the art gallery fired Wanda Nannybush, this is their indigenous curator, for making pro-Palestine comments or whatever happened in that situation, people were protesting outside the AGO. So, again, people wanted to make it illegal. You know, they're putting an art gallery as a vulnerable institution. And then also criminalizing speech, right? The saying that the words "from the river to the sea" was hate speech, or that it was calling for the genocide of Jews. I mean, these are some of the absurdities that we're seeing. And remember, we never had any of these bylaws in place before Israel's war on Gaza. These things didn't exist. The city had no issue with protests. So all of this is really the Palestine exception coming into full view.
For those who are unaware, what is the Palestine exception?
The Palestine exception really was born out of what we saw in newsrooms, first and foremost. So, for instance, you know, not being allowed to use the word Palestine in and of itself. And then also seeing that the way Palestine is covered is very different from other issues that are covered, right? We see the hypocrisy in coverage. So it was really born out of that. And then again, if we just relate it to the protests, for instance, all forms of protest are allowed in this city. But when it comes to Palestine, we're seeing all these new bylaws come into place. We're seeing speech being stifled. So all of that is what you can refer to as the Palestine exception.
My next question for you is, why should Torontonians be concerned about this bylaw, which we kind of touched on, and why should they fill out the survey?
And I think it's important for people to fill out this survey because the city needs to hear that, you know, this idea that we're all scared of protests is absurd, right? People need to understand that it is our right, as outlined in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, our freedom of expression, a freedom of assembly, is vital to a dynamic democracy, which is what I hope that the citizens of this city want this city to be. We want to have a flourishing, dynamic democracy. We want to be able to voice our dissent to Israel and beyond, whatever the issue is, right? It doesn't just end here. If we allow this to happen, it can happen with other things that people don't want you and I to be able to protest about. So this is a real litmus test, and we need to stop it right here and right now.
I don't want to ask a leading question, but it feels kind of fascist.
That's because it is kind of fascist. Yeah, absolutely. It's really fascism couched in the guise of safety, right? And fascism is never introduced to a society as, this is fascism, we want you to be okay with it. No, it's always couched in something. So here it's couched in the comfort of Zionist groups to be able to feel okay to shill for a genocide, and the rest of us just need to shut our mouths and be okay with it. It's couched in the language of safety and, you know, accommodating sort of religious groups and all that. We know what it's about. It never was born out of anything else. As I said, you know, with Ukraine, we saw hundreds of people in the streets. We saw thousands of people in the streets marching against what Russia is doing in Ukraine. There was never an issue, right? It's only on this one issue that we're seeing our speech stifled. We're seeing our freedoms of expression, our freedoms of assembly stifled.
Like you said, it's a Palestine exception.
Very much so.
What reason do you have to believe that it'll stop here? Like, once we get all the vulnerable zones set up, what comes next, in your opinion?
I mean, I'm afraid of what comes next, right? Because we're seeing laws put in place that would hinder my right to criticize Israel, really.
In Canada?
In Canada. If organizations in this country, Jewish or Zionist organizations, don't want to have people protesting outside of their synagogues, then they shouldn't be allowed to sell occupied lands inside that synagogue. What is so jarring about this is that the problem is not what is happening inside that synagogue. The problem for Canadian lawmakers, for some lawmakers in this city, is what's happening outside. The protests are the problem, not the sale of occupied lands, which is actually illegal under international and domestic law. That should be the issue, but it's not.
So what can Torontonians do, like other than filling out the survey, what can people in Toronto do to have their voices heard about the repression of protests and the criminalization of protesters?
I think people should write to their councillors. Find out who your city councillor is, write to them, and tell them that you are not okay with this quote unquote bubble zone or safety zone. You are not okay with safety, the fascism being couched in the language of safety and comfort. That is not something we want here in Canada. We're seeing the danger of that being exacted upon students right now in America. Is that what we really want to see in our country? If Pierre Poilievre gets elected, that's exactly what he wants to see.
Well, when the encampments were here, they were certainly not hesitant to call the police on those students either.
Exactly. I mean, we saw that the actions of students here were criminalized. We saw the University of Toronto getting an injunction against students. Some of those students are still facing a lot of problems because of speaking out against genocide. We saw the University of Alberta. I mean, they didn't even allow, or York University, they came in and clamped down on those students within the hour, brutally. And so that is a real danger.
I have a question for you about the Indigo 11. I believe most of them, the charges have been dropped against them. Do you think that their arrest has anything to do with the further criminalization of protesters in Toronto?
I mean, their arrests were so egregious, were so unbelievable to be. Their homes were raided, their doors were barricaded over, left off the hinges. I mean, this is how you go after major, drug runners, major criminals, murderers. This is how police raid their homes, not people who were protesting. And of course, we're seeing all of them being exonerated one after the other because they have pushed back on the Crown because of how egregious the police acted in these cases, right? And you can just look at the comparisons between how the 11 were treated versus how other people are treated in the law. I mean, we can see here that there again is this hypocrisy, this different behavior when it comes to people who are critical of Israel. I mean, Heather Reisman, the CEO, had the chief of police on speed dial. She spoke to him and demanded that this happen. You and I can't do that with the chief of police. So that just shows you that how the corporations, how these people are able to weaponize the law against people who are critical of Israel. We can't have this.
It's all connected at the end of the day.
It is really all connected. And the more we talk about those connections, the more important, and the less, the police gets to just act with impunity in the way that they have been.
What can the city itself do to ensure that Torontonians' rights to protest isn't further jeopardized?
Again, it really comes down to just speaking out, writing to your councillors, writing to the mayor of this city. Olivia Chow needs to understand that people won't allow for this to happen. We just need to continue speaking out, and I think getting louder and louder as the days go on, because there is a real, I'm not sure, I don't mean to sound alarmist, but what is happening south of our border can easily happen here.
Ideas don't stop at the border.
No, they don't. And we've seen that, right? We've already seen that. I mean, Danielle Smith, the premier of Alberta, going down, doing interviews with Breitbart, telling the world that if Poilievre is elected, that his beliefs and his, it will be much easier for him and Trump to get along, and how their ideologies align with one another. We heard her say that, right? As much as she likes to deny it, we heard the clips. We heard the interview on Breitbart News. So it can happen here.
I think a lot of Canadians are, maybe Torontonians are thinking that what's happening in the States or even what's happening in like Turkey right now with the repression of protesters cannot happen here. But it is kind of happening and it's happening under our noses.
It's happening under our noses, but it's also, a lot of people don't know these things. A lot of people don't know the way that the Indigo 11 were treated. Unfortunately, mainstream media doesn't really cover it as much as they should, which is why independent media is so important. I'm not sure why they don't cover it, but to think that 11 people who are not hardened criminals, who had their children inside those homes with them, were, you know, had their doors barricaded and were handcuffed, had all of their electronics confiscated and were treated in this way, is really quite atrocious for Canada.
What can those in power do to ensure that they're not continuing to erode our rights to protest?
Well, I mean, the mayor and the councillors can just not pass this bylaw. You know, it's as simple as that. There's no need to create bubble zones for quote unquote vulnerable institutions. Don't do it. There's no need for it. They are basically acquiescing to these groups who want to stifle speech against Israel's egregious behavior in Gaza.
Thank you so much, Samira. That was Samira. Thank you so much for your interview and your powerful words. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Samira Moyeddin and Rabble's Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, Ashley Ray Thomas, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Ashley Ray and Samira. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. For that, let's go over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news, the Green Party is calling on voters and other parties to focus on the climate ahead of this federal election. Donald Trump's threats to Canadian sovereignty and tariffs on Canadian goods have been at the forefront of this election, leaving little airtime for other important issues like the climate crisis. The only mention of climate policy this election has been about the carbon tax, which Prime Minister Mark Carney ended for general consumers. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has long campaigned to cut the carbon tax, but has made few other statements on the environment. In an exclusive interview with Rabble.ca, Green Party leader Elizabeth May explained why the climate crisis should be the most important issue, saying, quote, "I am frankly appalled that when climate science is so clear that we are running out of time and standing at the literal edge of too late, we have a federal election campaign in 2025 where only the Green Party is even raising climate, except to talk about the axing the tax," end quote. Rabble columnist Ole Henriksen also slammed Canada's two leading parties for ignoring the climate crisis. Henriksen explained that both the Liberals under Mark Carney and Pierre Poilievre's Conservatives have both essentially the same neoliberal outlook on the world. These neoliberal parties are prioritizing the economy over the environment, which could have dire global consequences. Henriksen said, quote, "Neoliberal leaders rule over an increasingly unstable planet in both political and environmental terms. The gap between rich and poor grows ever wider. Environmental degradation and climate breakdown accelerate, with more fires, floods, and tornadoes," end quote. Health is another national issue that has not received enough attention this election. In her column this month, Evelyn Lazar explained how the Canadian Medical Association is working to keep healthcare as a major issue in the election. At a recent Canadian Medical Association summit, attendees were introduced to key issues in Canada's healthcare system, from staffing shortages to AI. The summit stressed that although it might seem that individuals have few options to affect the deficiencies in the healthcare system, that is not necessarily the case. In the column, Lazar lists ways to lobby politicians to help to get them to listen to voters on important issues like healthcare. Lazar recommended approaching politicians with research, a concise message, and a personal story, for example. "We have many opportunities to keep healthcare concerns at the forefront of the election," Lazar writes. "Let's not waste those chances to make a significant difference." Staying in health news, it has been 5 years since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. In an op-ed on Rabble, Jacob Shire explains that the COVID-19 virus continues to be with us and remains deadly, especially for those with compromised immune systems. Shire said that the tendency of media outlets and politicians to talk about the pandemic in the past tense is a way to try and close the narrative on a difficult time in our collective history. However, many people continue to be infected by COVID-19, and there are those who continue to live with long COVID. By talking about COVID-19 as something in the past, this has allowed elected officials to cut funding for preventive measures like masking, vaccines, and treatment for those with long COVID. And finally, in provincial news, a by-election last week in the city of Vancouver saw two progressive candidates elected to city council. Sean Orr of the Coalition of Progressive Electors and Lucy Maloney of One City.